ladder that was two wall, you know what I'm talking about.
Digital warbles.
I'm not sure why I've got everything correct. And
you have, make sure you have nothing, like, is there nothing near the microphone, like a cell phone or some other energy source that might be interfering with a signal or...
The Eye of Agamotto say...
You didn't say it!
You said it! Oh, my God!
It's going to be okay. I've got the Wand of Watoom over here. They just cancel each other out. Yeah, it's fine.
I got your Wand of Watoom, buddy.
And he does. He does.
Wow. All right. Man.
Well, let's try it. And
cutting out. Dude, you're cutting out now. It almost sounds like you're being auto-tuned.
Is there any way we could work in a Guardians of the Galaxy connection to him fading in and out?
I'm sure we'll find a way if he does starts doing it a lot.
Or we could just say that Mark mentioned the eye of that yes, shall not be yes. named, and it's messing with...
My God. Yeah.
Joseph right, was yeah, unshielded. We'll,
that's become our Scottish play, yeah.
It really has.
We don't talk about it. Okay. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge, home of the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are all gathered together to discuss the newest Marvel Fantastic Journey into Outer Space, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2. Here in the Lobot Lounge, we have Mr. Mickey Finn.
Oh, God, what is it with that arrow?
Mark Finn.
All right, showtime, a-holes.
Aaron DeOrive.
Only he didn't say frickin'.
And I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. No, I'm Joseph Fortinos, your host and emotional touchstone. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge and the Gentlemen Nerds as we talk about the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Wow.
Yeah.
Yes. Very excited. Very excited.
I'd like to start out by complimenting Aaron on his Rocket Raccoon impression. Yes. I've been working on one as well. So it's nice to know that we have double coverage on the anthropomorphic homicidal raccoon category.
Oh, yeah. Come on. I mean, if you watch those movies, how can you not love either Groot and or Rocket? Come on.
Yeah. And I'm a huge Rocket fan from ages ago. So when I found out he was going to be in the first movie, I was like, yes. And everybody's like,
so you were. You liked Rocket before it was cool. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
I liked him when he had a gig as Ranger Rick. So, you know.
Nice.
All right. Well, that was the show. Great.
Yep. Thanks. Bye-bye. See you all. No. All right.
Yeah, so, the review is, it was good. Go see it.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I do love these movies. I think that it is refreshing and wonderful to have a decent space opera being done by other than something that has Star Wars in front of it.
Oh, yeah.
And I really appreciate the humor in this space opera. That they certainly are bringing fun back into space opera. Again, not that the Star Wars movies are not. I think they are. I think Abrams sort of realized that was the one aspect that was missing from the Star Wars movies at the time, after the prequels. And so he just wanted to bring back a lot of fun and humor. And I think he captured that in The Force Awakens. So these movies are amazing in that respect. If you want to go and just have your mouth hurt from smiling and grinning and laughing, this is the movie for you. Very much enjoyed it. Again, solid performances on everyone's part. I love the chemistry between all the characters. And like I said, it, how can you watch these movies and not be a fan of Groot and or Rocket? Those characters are just fun. But I mean, I had some quibbles with it, and we'll get into that a little bit later. I want to hear what my fellow nerds, just their first impressions of it. But I loved it. I loved it.
I think that we all loved it. I had a little bit of quibbles too. My favorite parts of this of Volume 2. Really, I could have watched Yondu and Rocket for hours. I could have watched those two and really enjoyed the newer characters that showed up. I loved Mantis. I thought they did a really good job with her. And spoiler alert, folks, but the villain, it's Ego, the living planet. How cool is that?
Holy God.
I mean, yeah. Never in my lifetime would I have imagined that I'd be in a movie and there he is, the planet with a face on it. And I'm just like,
and they even managed to put it Yeah, they even managed to put it in one scene where it actually had the face.
Yeah. I'm with Joseph. I'm like, no, there's no, oh my God. they did it. They made that character and put it in a movie. It's like amazing.
James Gunn is an expert at taking things that are no, you can't do that in a film, and doing them sometimes to his detriment in his early works, like, you know, Slither. It wasn't quite as, but from Guardians on, it's like, you know, give him enough toys to play with and he doesn't fall down with them. He knows what to do with the toys.
Okay, okay. One, Slither is awesome. You are wrong. Two, Guardians 2 is great.
It's not a bad movie.
I think almost if you liked there are certain things that everybody really liked about the first Guardians of the Galaxy. I won't say that I necessarily liked them. But a lot of people did, and it's in the second movie that he doubles down on those things, and in doubling down on those things, I found I liked this movie more than the first one. It does have its quibbles, but I think it succeeds way more than it fails, and I think it does something that I've only recently kind of like copped to. That is absolutely needed in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, I do very much want to hear that and talk about that, because I think you and I might be thinking something along the same lines. But no, absolutely, they're it's fun. That is the only word that keeps coming to my mind to describe this movie. This movie was fun. If you want to have a good time, go see it.
Let's dive in and get into some details here, because we have just gushed all over this table, and we're gonna have to wipe this up. But then I want to get specific. The opening mirrored in a lot of ways the opening of the original, which I still prefer the original. I enjoy the original more. But the opening of the original, not the Peter Quill's mother dying in the hospital, but the opening, the credits. As Star-Lord is dancing through the planet and Come and Get Your Love by Redbone is playing in the soundtrack. Here, we have a mirrored opening, but it's Baby Groot dancing to ELO's Mr. Blue Sky as the Guardians themselves are battling this space octopus thing.
Drax is looking.
Exactly. And see, the things like that where they kind of, hey guys, remember how cute that was in the first movie? Look at that. Hey guys, remember how cute that was in the first movie? Look at this. The references were very reflective of the first movie, which I don't have a problem with. But like the Drax bit in the battle, as Baby Groot is dancing and Drax is tossed down to the ground, he gets up and looks at Baby Groot, and Baby Groot freezes like he did in the end of this of the first one. Right. And then he looks back and he looks up, he looks back and looks up, and then he gets back and goes, "Fine." Again, that was cute, but it's just cute for cute's sake. In a way,
it actually makes a little sense later. Did you want to say?
Yeah, let me offer a counter read on that, Joseph, for you. And it's meta, okay? Baby Groot was a scene stealer at the end of Guardians, and knowing that he was only going to be a little bit bigger at the end of this movie makes it what would have happened. If there'd not been a scene where he's dancing and Drax notices, there would have been a hue and cry for, I wanted to see more dancing Baby Groot. I wanted to see Baby Groot dancing. I think putting it in a cold open like this in media res and actually going, you know, you want more dancing Groot? Here's dancing Groot. You put it at the beginning where it kind of doesn't matter, because at the end it didn't matter of the first one. It was really kind of a throwaway to let you know that Groot's going to be back. So putting it here at the beginning like this and just letting him go while the other, because it doesn't really matter the other thing. We've seen these kinds of things before. It's actually more fun to pull focus away from the monster, classically speaking, I might add. You only show tentacles and mouths and stuff. And show the reactions as people get the crap kicked out of them and kind of go, you know, shake their heads. Yeah. And then they jump back into the fracas. We never see the battle from the edges. So he kind of does a really smart idea. Get the dancing baby Groot out of the way, because there's nowhere to put it anywhere else, and do something a little different with a traditional opening scene, full of action and excitement, you know?
It's a matter of tone. Yeah. From the very beginning, they're telling you what you are in store for. And I appreciate that, because I agree with Mark. We have seen an opening with the heroes battling whatever, you know, the menace of the day, 1,000 times. So that is not interesting, no matter how great the CGI is and how stunning the fight choreography or whatever. So that's exactly correct. To put that in the background, we know that, we've seen it, we're familiar with it, and focus on little baby Groot doing his wonderful little dance moves while the battle rages around him, not only I think is a wonderful beginning. That's one of my favorite parts of the movie, by the way, is that opening. It lets you know, this is the kind of movie you are in store for. It's going to be fun. It's going to be funny. Look at the dancy little baby plant. Yeah, who cares about the Cthuloid monster who's battling our heroes? Right. But look, he's so cute. And so for me, it was tonally spot on.
And my favorite part of that whole sequence, is Gamora's exchange with Groot. When she goes, Groot, get out of the way, and she goes, hi. And she went, you know, she stopped. Yeah.
waves at him.
Yeah, hi, you know, like a little mom. Like, oh, there he is. Hi, baby. Yeah, you know, I just love that. That's the best.
But the character moments are reflected later as well. They have another battle that they completely ignore half the battle so that they can, you know, have an argument in a tunnel while the battle's going on behind them. You know,
Right. You don't need. I think in the same way, that's actually funny. They put it in the trailer, but it's actually funnier in the movie because they skillfully cut out all the stuff where Peter actually goes to the people and asks them for tape. I actually like that more. Yes. You know? Again, you can hear it, and I like the fact that, you know, Rocket and Groot are just kind of sitting there listening. You know.
But also the thing with Drax, he freezes when Drax sees him. Later on is reflected in there are dancers and there are non-dancers. Mm-hmm. And it's like Groot knows this, and he never wants to let Drax see him dance because he wants to be in a certain category.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's funny. I never thought of that. That's actually quite brilliant. He wants to seem cool and tough and relevant to Drax. So he doesn't want to see doesn't want Drax to see him dance. That's great.
That's actually very, very insightful there. I hadn't thought of that either. That's a brilliant way to look at it, is that he only freezes when Drax looks at him because he doesn't want Drax to think he's an idiot because he's a dancer.
Exactly.
The problem with that, of course, being that it's only a thing in retrospect. When it happens, you don't know Drax's opinion yet, except from the previews. So
that's really smart though, in order for that to set that up like that. The other thing, let's keep talking about Groot, since we're gonna, I think we should approach this by focusing on character. Let's cover Groot here for a bit. I like the idea that as Groot is growing and with these characters and like a baby, and it is, and so there's a lot of parental themes that are on display here, and there's plenty of them. But as far as Groot goes, I like the idea that people are understanding him. For example, in the first movie, only Rocket could understand what he was saying. They would say, "I am Groot," and Rocket would say, "Yeah, he says this. I am Groot." And then by the end of this movie, it literally, and this is one of the spoilers for the little tags at the end, Peter Quill goes into teenage Groot's room and talks with him, and teenage Groot says, "I am Groot. I'm not stupid." Like, he understood him now. Right. You know, he's starting to under. I mean, he can actually speak. "I am Groot."
Yeah.
You know, which is a great thing, a great way that, of course, eventually you'd start to understand what he was saying.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I love the idea that they're growing with him now.
And I love
Groot. I know how Yondu always feels. That was good.
I absolutely love Groot's body language and facial expressions as teenage Groot.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Because it captures it perfectly.
Even yes,
his
it does.
Response, you know, the rolling of the eyes, like, I am Groot. It's like, okay, yeah. I can hear what that dialogue should be as oh, God, I have no time for you. I can't even teenager. Yeah.
Yeah. As the father of a 15-year-old, I can tell you that is perfect, spot on.
The fun about this is that we really haven't seen Groot at full potential yet. I know Joseph knows that Groot originally showed up as a giant monster during the Atlas era of Marvel Comics. One of the many things was along the lines of Fin Fang Foom all those guys. And so there is a point, if they do not prune him, so to speak, that Groot would continue his growth and literally become a 20-foot-tall walking tree ant, you know? Right.
At the end of Ragnarok, he replaces the world tree.
Nice.
Yeah.
I made that up, by the way.
I don't think we're going to get that, but I do like, but yeah, it's nice to know that I'd like to think at some point in time, after, you know, college-age Groot is surpassed and we get into adult mature Groot, that the monster comes out. That'd be kind of fun, because then they really have something, you know. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of the Guardians of the Galaxy walking around with a cave troll, you know.
Yeah,
right.
Well, there is a bit of the monster in him. I mean, he right now I would call him maybe a toddler, a baby Groot. I mean, mm-hmm. he's a baby, right. But you know, his temperament is like a toddler. Like during the opening sequence when he sees one of those little lizard things and just goes to town beating the crap out of it, you know, just loses his mind. when he's picked on by the Ravagers and then Yondu and Rocket turn it around, he takes very great pleasure in singling out one of them.
Yeah.
And he goes, nah, I'm taking care of this. He goes up there and he does what he needs to do, screaming, right. I am Groot. This little tiny thing is, and he's terrifying the guy. He's trying to run away and this, you know, tree monster grabbing him. And then he comes back down. Okay, I'm done. I've done my thing. You know, I've got it out. Just like any toddler who gets upset with a playmate or gets mad and just wants to hit because they're angry. Yeah. You know,
that's they throw a tantrum and then they're
yeah,
done.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And there is a scene, if you blink, you miss it, whenever they're escaping the planet, when Drax is running towards the ship and he says, get out of the way, smaller, weaker Groot. And he dives into the hole. And as he dives into the hole, Groot runs up and just tat, 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 hits him a few times. As if to say, I'm not smaller and weaker.
Yes. Yes.
It's such a great little bit, you know, like that's all he's got is his beauty little fists, you know.
If you didn't catch it, that wonderful sequence where he keeps bringing back the wrong items because he doesn't understand the difference between a hat and something else.
Yeah.
The eye that he brings back, the cybernetic eye, is the eye that Rocket wanted as part of the joke when they were on the Ravager ship.
In the beginning,
I need that guy's eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's the same eye.
Yeah. I love the toe was my favorite.
Yes.
Oh my God.
The toe.
My wife couldn't breathe.
And just the expression on Rocket and Yondu's face. And Rocket's like, please tell me that you have a room in here that's covered in body parts or something. No.
It's just agree not to talk toe.
About that. Yeah.
So here's the thing. So all, by the way, so all through the first, I would say, probably a good 3/4 of the movie, I had that feeling. I was happy. I was smiling. Loved all the characters, loved the chemistry, loved continuing the complex relationship between Nebula and Gamora.
Oh, yes.
That played out very nicely.
Yeah.
So again, I'm pleased. The wonderful meeting between the two innocents, you know, Mantis and Drax sort of interacting with each other. The two kids trying to figure out what's going on. That's well done. So I was along for the ride. I was really glad. I was loving this movie. And then I think this is where it went off a little bit off the rails for me. It ran into the same problem that I think a lot of these movies almost inevitably run into, and especially because Mark pointed something out, and I wanted to talk about that in a little bit. But Mark pointed out that these movies have sort of become the default Fantastic Four, mm-hmm. like the the sort of epic cosmic stories that we got used to in the Fantastic Four and that we read in the Fantastic Four for decades. Since there really is no Fantastic Four right now with Marvel, they're sort of doing that with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and it seems appropriate. They're flying around in the galaxy and encountering things like Ego and things like that. But
and it's Adam when Warlock.
I'm so glad they're going to introduce Adam Warlock. But that's where it started to sort of fall apart a little bit for me, because in my mind, the Guardians are not the Fantastic Four. And so when things started getting a little bit cosmic and we have the battle between, you know, Ego and Star-Lord, and there are these godlike creatures and they're bashing each other, quite honestly, that's when I checked out. That is when I checked out. I was less interested in what was happening to the main characters then, and specifically Star-Lord. When it would cut back to Gamora, what's Gamora doing? What's Drax doing on the ship? What's Rocket doing? Still invested. But once you take a character to that level, it's almost like I didn't fear for Star-Lord, and not because I know they're not going to kill the characters, because that doesn't apply. I still worry about characters in a movie, in a franchise movie. I'm like, oh gosh, you know, but because just like, oh yeah, well look, it's two gods battling it out. It might as well at that point have been that opening battle with the octopoid creature that I didn't care about battling, you know, off screen, while I focused on something more interesting like group dancing.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think anybody there were as of yet undiscovered tribes in the heart of the Peruvian jungle who knew Ego was going to be a bad guy. You know, there's not a whole lot of surprise there. So for me, it was just biding your time, and they're drawing it out. And like, come on with the reveal. You know, Mantis has a secret. She's not going to tell. We know what the secret is. Hurry and get to it. That got a little tedious. I think it could have used some editing in that middle section to cut that part down, because every time they cut back to it, I was, oh God, I'm going to close my eyes here for a second, because Kurt Russell and Chris Pratt are sitting there talking about the lyrics to Brandy, which, you know, that's great. No, it's very, very Tarantino. Tarantino-esque to have that moment of them dissecting Looking Glass's Brandy and making it, you know, apply to their life. Yeah, that's great. It's brilliant. Can we move on to where Ego's a bad guy? Because we know it's coming. All right.
I will tell you this, and it's sort of a weird thing to be excited about. I knew in the first movie that having contact with an alien is what made her sick. I mean, I just assumed. And I assumed after a second watching, because we don't know, you know, anything as you're watching the first movie. You just know that she's sick, and then he gets picked up by space pirates, and then afterwards that's why she's sick. And they don't say it's cancer. It could be leukemia, you know, the way that they're doing it. It's hard to know. Then, of course, we find out in this movie, and my suspicions were confirmed the whole time they're talking, until he turns around and says, "It killed me to put that tumor in her head." And I went, "Holy shit, he's awful." You know, and that was the one, that was the surprise for me. You know, that was the reveal, is that not only did he kill her, he intentionally killed her.
Right.
And so I thought he was nuanced. I liked that. I liked that a lot. I was less bored by the proceedings, and I was more overwhelmed by them, I guess. And this is the thing, you know, their response is to blow shit up, which I thought was great. We'll just blow things up. We'll just shoot things, you know. And there was just an awful lot of things to shoot.
I got a little.
Maybe it was scope, because I like that you said overwhelmed, because maybe that is it. When they're bashing each other through the multiple layers of the planet and punching each other, and they're both glowing, and it distanced me. I'm like, okay, it's these two cosmic forces battling, and it wasn't the character that I liked anymore. It wasn't the let's have a dance off Star-Lord. And I'm like, no, I want that no. guy. I want the let's have a dance off Star Lord.
Yeah,
I
don't but want... to be fair, we are talking about a little more heady. The battle means more. There's a little bit more to it. It's my father, you know.
No, and you know, I absolutely get that they tried to frame it that way.
Yeah, but if he would have suddenly went, it's a dance off, turd man, let's go. You know, we'd have been like, what? Come on. You know, that, I think that there's a time and a place for that. What I disagree with my brother from another mother, Mark, about with Ego's revelation about putting the cancer in Quill's mother's head didn't surprise me at all.
Okay.
In fact, it's just one of those, like, okay, he's a bad guy. Oh yeah. Guess what? He killed her. Yep. Got it. Because I know he didn't love her. You could tell in that CGI young Kurt Russell, which is brilliant, by the way, at the beginning of the movie, the way he was looking at her, he wasn't looking at her like he loved her. He was looking at her like she's a toy. I'm using her. I mean, that's the vibe I got from the beginning.
Now
let's not forget his name is Ego.
Maybe
his very name is Ego, right?
Mark, I was hoping that it wouldn't have been that. I mean, I agree with Mark that it would have been more effective. I was even hoping they would go in a direction, which, I mean, thankfully they didn't, but where the Kurt Russell character as an avatar of Ego was actually almost separate from Ego, the living planet, sent out this avatar to go do these things. And maybe the avatar was starting to become humanized. He actually did love her. He actually did have feelings for her, even though that's not what his mission was. That's not what he was there for.
That would have been a little too Silver Surfer / Galactus, and it might have been a little too on the nose.
Right, right. But to have him just, you know, he meets the mother, he falls in love, supposedly falls in love with her, impregnates her, puts the tumor in her head, and then flies off to the next planet to do the same thing. To me, just, I mean, it made everything really pointless. It's like, oh, okay, so a big bad cosmic villain basically killed his mom. Okay, get mad, Star-Lord, and go fight him. You know, that's where I detach. I don't care about cosmic beings battling each other. I care about a young man's love for his mother who died of cancer. I care about a young man's quest to try to find who his father was. I care about what relationship that dying mother might have had with his father. And when it's cheapened to the point where it's, nah, she was just a tool of a bad guy. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm done. What's Groot doing?
Now, to go insert this after Mark was commenting about Ego revealing this to begin with, I will say there was some nice nuance in the fact that he was presenting it as if it was some great sacrifice that it killed him to do this.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's
because
a narcissist, didn't it?
Yeah, he's trying to get Peter to sacrifice his adopted family. Yeah. And he's approaching it as a sacrifice, not understanding at all how it works.
He's just turning it all about him, making it all about him. Yes. Again, his name is Ego.
Yes.
Right. So everything's about him.
And I
love it. Really, it was horrible that I had to do that. Oh, poor me. I had to put that in. I really hated it.
And Kurt Russell is perfect for that.
Oh, yeah.
I do think they win me back over at the end, though. Well, for one thing, you know, I agree that the Godling fight was a little much, but it's also a temporary condition, right? As soon as Ego goes away, so does Peter Quill's divinity.
Thank God.
That's not going to really come up again. Or if it does, it'll come up in a tiny way. It'll come up in a nascent way, the way, you know, his DNA is still part Celestial, so he can hold Infinity Stones. That doesn't leave, but energy projecting Star Lord doesn't come back probably. Right. So, but where this comes back in is Gunn does an amazing job of turning all this chaos into family drama.
Right. I love the family drama. Yes.
And that's when it hit me. This idea that they're the family, you know, even though they're the family that they've chosen rather than the family that's kind of together, you know, but they're the family that can't stop bickering and squabbling. And I think Nebula even uses the word bickering at one point, which is what kind of made me go, oh, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You know, and mind you, on my Facebook feed, this got turned into a Farscape discussion, which is not at all. Well, because people wanted to talk about space pirates rather than the idea that you have these four people who are, you know, sent into space, get powers, and come back to Earth, and those powers don't help, and they end up, and you know, early on, like as early as Fantastic Four number four, the Submariner's making a play for Sue Storm, and she's almost into it because Reed's always in the lab. I mean, you know, these guys, it's they're not a rock solid foundational family here, and so I love the fact that every one of them has daddy issues.
Well, that's a great segue.
Sibling rivalry, you know.
Yeah, that's a great segue because I want to move on. We've done the Peter Quill and Ego bit. We've done the group bit. I want to focus on my favorite character, my standout, my scene stealer, and everything he did, and that was Michael Rooker's Yondu.
Yes.
And because, you know, what that great quote he said, he goes, he may have been your father, boy, but he was not your daddy. That is totally right. Now, the character of Yondu, vastly different than your comic book character. I mean,
on a magnitude of 100.
Yeah, because in the comic book, he's more of like a noble American Indian style warrior. You know, he's got the way he talks and the way he, you know, with the bow and arrow and things like that. And they've made this Yondu a little bit, well, like Michael Rooker. He's a little bit of a Southern sleaze, you know, he's got that, which it's okay. It works for this. They made it work. And in the sadness that it's reflected in that opening scene when we first see him again, and he's in that house of ill repute, I would go out and say, I guess, that little party house that him and the Ravagers are at. And he's standing there, shirtless, looking out the window, and just sad, looking sad and dejected and lonely, with no link or connection or family, feeling, what's the point, you know? And throughout the course of the film, you know, by the end of it, he does the most amazing thing. You know, he does gives the greatest gift anyone can give to someone that they love, which is to lay down their life, knowing, let me do this. This is what I want to do. And not doing it for any reward or expectation of reward or a Ravager's funeral, which he does get, but he didn't do it for that. And that's the important part. He did it selflessly. He did it because he loved Peter, you know, and that's beyond a doubt makes Yondu such a more multifaceted character than anything I ever saw in that movie. He was the one that really had change and development and growth. And, you know, when he confronted Rocket and he was like, you know, you are me. You are exactly, I recognize you. I know exactly who, don't try to lie to me, boy. I know exactly who you are. You know?
I knew where that speech was going and I didn't care.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't care that it was tropish. It was Michael Rooker delivering those lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is Rocket is the most unchanged in the movie. Mm-hmm. Everybody else seems to have accepted that. Well, Peter and Rocket are the most unchanged in the movie. You know, I mean, Quill is trying to be a leader to these folks. Rocket's not having any, and so that's where the initial tension comes in. It's basically Ben Grimm and Reed Richards, you know. And so I think that it works, you know, because the Ravagers Brotherhood is a family. There's a lot of sads. There's a lot of feels in this film, you know. Yondu is excised from his original Ravager group, which is why he had to go make his own group and basically make a family. And when he picks up Peter Quill, he realizes that if I give this kid to Ego, Ego's going to basically eat him and throw him in the abattoir. Yeah. I think we'll keep him, you know, and just, you know, not tell everybody, you know, why we've reneged on this job. You know, in fact, all of the decisions that Yondu makes in the two movies that gets him to this place are because of Quill. He sacrificed. He doesn't just sacrifice his life for Quill. He basically is a less successful Ravager because he's got to keep, you know, not killing Peter Quill when Quill goes off the reservation.
Right. So, and by the way, and that is where Gunn, I think, does redeem himself. You know, Mickey had said earlier about, you know, hey, Gunn smartly does this. And that could be why, you know, Peter goes off to godfight with Dad. That then allows us to focus on Yondu and to focus on the much more human, relatable situation of a parent, which is what Yondu was. Right. So I agree. I think maybe that's what the reason to do that. That was the attempt there. It's like, okay, they're off doing godlike things, but you know what? Look over here. Here's where the human interest story is happening.
Yeah.
And because it is Yondu's arc, Yondu's decisions, Yondu's story in this were also one of my favorites. I thought that was really, really well done. So it wasn't a total loss. I just, there was a moment there, cause that's one thing, in the early Fantastic Four, none of them, even when they were fighting godlike creatures, when they were fighting Galactus and things like that, you know, none of them ever became godlike. They were still very human, still very much a bickering family that always had to come together to solve, well, how are we going to beat this godlike entity, this cosmic entity?
Yeah.
And then Reed with his brains and Ben with his gumption and, you know, Johnny with his bravado, they would figure out a way to do it. I will take back a little bit of my criticism. I still didn't like them cosmicking out Peter. That didn't work for me, but I love it. If that was necessary to give us the Yondu stuff, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Well, it's also worth mentioning that and I like this too. You know, at some point I expected Peter to fall under Ego's thrall, but as soon as he hears what happened to his mother, his first instinct is to literally shoot his father to pieces.
Yeah.
Like that's I was so happy to see that, because there's not this, I need to think, you know, there's not this hanging from the weather vane going, no,
right.
There's draw gun, shoot face, you know. Yeah,
he already covered the whole Fleetwood Mac chains.
Right.
Which one's my real family? He'd already gone through that. Once the mother's death came into it, it's like, no, fuck this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that all worked out, I think, because we have relationships all over this film. Baby Groot and as the child that they all share. Drax and Mantis, Aaron said earlier, the two innocents. But I somehow came away with it that Drax was using her as sort of a surrogate substitute for his own daughter, who he lost. That he was seeing her as a daughter as opposed to an equal. That he, because he, the way he talked to her and treated her was just like, you are ugly. You are incredibly ugly. And, you know, you're a weird bug girl. Look at this weird bug girl. But by the end, you know, he was fatherly and said things like, you're beautiful on the inside. You know, that's sort of as best, the best that Drax the Destroyer can do on that with his notoriously large turds that he was very proud of. And then we've got the sister relationship between Nebula and Gamora. And by the way, let me just go on record as saying something about Nebula just turns me on. I don't know what it is.
You never watched Doctor Who, right?
Some of it, not a whole lot, but
Karen Gillan played Amy, who's one of the
she was one of these.
The fact that she is able to put so much raw emotion and power through that makeup and costuming is incredible.
I don't recognize her character from Doctor Who in Nebula at all.
She is it's astounding. In this. As a matter of fact, I've always had a complaint about Gamora, because you don't hire Zoe Saldana to play a character that's kind of strong but kind of emotionally not there. I mean, Zoe Saldana is like this fierce force of nature for roles like this, and so she always seemed to be outshined by Nebula. You know,
No, I don't think so at all. I think Nebula. The problem with Nebula is that she's consumed, and she's singular in her vision, and that makes her intense. But you know, Saldana, but Gamora at the beginning of this movie, she's the heart of the film, or she's the heart of the Guardians of the Galaxy. She's the one that's figured out that they are a family. They're the family that they've chosen.
And that's where I was going, was that was in the first film that I felt that way. Whereas in the second film, I don't, largely in part to her interactions with Nebula in this.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I would say, you know, exactly. Gamora simmers, whereas Nebula boils.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But Gamora always has that that intensity to her. And again, much thanks to Zoe Saldana, who does that. Whenever Gamora is talking or whenever Gamora is looking at somebody, you can see that she's suppressing all of the crap that happened between her and her dad and, you know, in her youth. But it's still there. Whereas Nebula is just Nebula, her top is blown and she's just full of rage.
And Nebula gets underneath her skin and causes her to actually have, you know, more violent reactions.
Right.
But when it does boil out, when that intensity does boil out, it boils out in I don't know what Cheers is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or her picking up, which I loved, her picking up Gamora picking up the ship's gun,
yes,
and right, firing at her as she's walking towards her. You know, I'm like, wow, that's a great scene.
Which brings to mind when that happened, and I thought, you know, visually it was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I thought, how strong is she? How strong are
she's
all
augmented.
Of them?
Yeah. I mean, she's pretty strong.
She's augmented all to hell.
She's the daughter of Thanos. I mean,
no, I get all that, but I mean, There were parts in like Guardians of the Galaxy 1 where she couldn't get through a door, and I thought, here she's picking up this gigantic, I don't know, thousands of pounds of metal and firing it, standing holding it while she's firing it, yet she couldn't get through a door in the first one. So I thought, wait a second.
In the first one, there's also blink and you miss it. You know, she jumps huge distances.
Yes, no, I got that. Yeah, and I'm okay with the jumping, just the raw power. I mean, if we open the handbook of the Marvel Universe. It in the list of powers, it
how
should
many
say
tons
how
can
many
she
tons
lift?
Could she bench press? Right?
You know,
Spider-Man can do 10. I know that. He can do 10 tons.
Attribute that to her rage. I attribute it that she was so mad at that point that she almost hulked out, you know?
Yeah, maybe she's got an adrenal boost. Who knows?
And it's a small quibble, but it was one of the things I was like, wait a minute.
But you're right.
Firing the gun?
It makes a great visual, but don't think about it too much because the logic will start to break down.
Just the recoil from firing the gun should have like propelled her backwards, you know?
Yeah, if there had been some sort of reaction to instead of just holding it,
I think it's such a great visual. It's such a great visual.
No, hands down. But you know what? What James Gunn does really well in this film and in the original one, and I think it makes the movie in a lot of ways. Mind you, the characters, the amazing visuals, the story, all that's great. The soundtrack is so vital to his movies, to these movies.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And this was no exception. The Volume 2 soundtrack is, oh my gosh, you've got, you know, Mr. Blue Sky, of course, we talked about that. One of my favorite songs ever to open. Brandy was not only, you know, in the movie, but an incredibly important part of the movie. They dissect it and they use it as a story about these two and leaving your love behind. My life, my love, my lady is the sea. But then things like George Harrison's My Sweet Lord as you're approaching Ego. I thought, I'll never hear Glenn Campbell's Southern Nights without thinking of Rocket kicking ass on that planet and just basically taking apart the Ravagers, you know, single-handedly. Love that, you know, and he's laughing and he's you know, just taking them all out and Southern Nights is playing and he's leaping from tree to tree.
And
just,
knows,
okay, so that, but
he knows ahead. The song, by the way, which means that it's,
well, it's playing on the ship.
It's bleeding over to the other characters, the love of the
Exactly. Peter forces them to listen to this.
Well, and then when he's with Yondu and they have their mutiny revolt, or they break out and they take out the other Ravagers. Even he says, hey, do we have any of Peter's old music on this ship? Rocket requests it.
Yes.
Do you have any of Peter's old music? Put that on. And it's Get a Little Bit Closer, you know, which is, oh my gosh, that is such Come a Little Bit Closer by Jay and the Americans. To have them doing that while that song is playing and in slow motion. And let's all take a moment and bow our heads for Taserface.
Oh, God. You know, by the way, that is another thing. Total, complete kudos to Gunn for being able to take an ensemble film like this and to not feel as if any of the characters were cheated. That, my God, let me tell you, from a screenwriting perspective, hats off. That is hard to do. There are so many characters in this, and yet each one had a fantastic moment, emotionally resonant, impactful, fit the story perfectly. I mean, whoa, that... That is some skill there, guys. That just does not happen, you know, through osmosis. That's amazing. So, man, everyone, Rocket had his moment. Groot had his moment. Yondu had his moment. Gamora had, I mean, all of them. Holy cow, how do you do that, you know?
But did Taserface have a moment?
Yes, he did.
Oh, he did. That's the best part.
He got a great death scene and an appropriate response to his death.
And Aisha, or, you know, she, basically, who is, you know, their appointed leader or chosen leader or whatever, she's so, you know, stoic and straight, and then when Taserface tells her his name, she goes, she starts laughing.
Isn't that brilliant? I thought that was amazing.
And there were so many. They're so serious about everything, and then, you know, when they're piloting their ships remotely, it's arcade sounds, and you've got everybody gathered around the one surviving ship as if it's at an arcade and he's about to beat the top level, you know.
Right. Well, but even she laughs. Even she laughs at Taserface.
Yes.
Yeah. I do think all of that was well handled. I want to just say one more thing about the soundtrack, and not the inclusion of Cheap Trick, which is always welcome. But the fact that this, I like the soundtrack better for the sheer absence of the escape song. I am glad that if you like Pina Coladas, did not come back into the soundtrack. It is the thing that spoils the soundtrack for the first movie for me.
There's no repeat from movie to movie, is there? They never.
No, there's not. No, okay, there's not. I absolutely, the Pina Colada song is a cultural kryptonite to me. And I'm so glad that even though there's some stuff on this second soundtrack that's I'm okay with, but not great. Every time I hit a song that I don't like, I go, you know what? It's not Rupert Holmes. Awesome. Yeah, awesome.
But you know what? The Pina Colada song, it's like Tang. It may be embarrassing, but God damn it happened. And it was a part of that period and it influenced a lot of people. So
and what are the chances?
I might agree with you that the song's not the best, but oh my God, if you like Pina Coladas, that immediately brings you to a specific time.
Yeah, I know.
And what are the chances that either one of them have ever been to the dunes on the Cape, much less like making love there? I mean, what are the chances, really?
it's such a cheese ball line, you know? It's so...
No, it is. You know, it's a
you're
bad...
Just put that in your profile song to get attention.
So, yeah, okay, Birch, you know, sidebar. Birch Sugarman's Midnight Special, which was a 1970s and 80s basically song showcase. It had the bands come on, people... When Rupert Holm came on to Burt Sugarman's Midnight Special, they did, well, we got to do something. He's here. He's got this hit. It's about a pina colada. I know what we'll do. We'll have him go up to the band before him and serve them pina coladas. I kid you not. He runs up with a tray and he goes, pina colada, pina colada, pina colada. And the other bands take pina coladas. And then he rushes back to his stage to sing his song.
Yeah.
It is the Macarena of its age.
You cannot
escape that song. I'm actually glad that it was included for that reason. I mean, it left such a stamp on that era.
And they had that one original song that Gunn himself with the Sneepers, his band or part of the band that he was doing. And David Hasselhoff is featured on there as well, singing with that. And it's he described it as being like that Miko Star Wars cantina band from the 70s, the disco version of the Star Wars theme. That's what he was going for, is that feel. And I could kiss the man on the lips for that, because that's a real cultural touchstone for me, is that song. And so when I saw and I heard what he was doing during the credits, and by the way, let's talk about those spoilers and the credits and those end credits and the multiple end scenes, because we're wrapping this up here. But the credits as they're going by and you see the little images of them and the dancing, the characters are dancing, all of them are dancing, you know,
and Nebula, they also the photos, the photos look like 1970s gum cards.
Bubble
gum
sticker cards.
I Am Groot shows up as several things in there.
Oh yes. I mean that whole exchange there at the end. And then hands down my favorite Stan Lee cameo.
Yes.
Ever. Hands down, my favorite Stan. Yeah. It wraps it all together.
It explains everything. Yeah.
It gives him, and Stan's not a young man anymore. So if he's no longer with us, you know, in a few years, this is how I'm going to remember him. Eternally sitting on the moon in a spacesuit, talking to the Watchers.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuck there.
One time I was a Federal Express man.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
The Watchers, so the Watchers are just looking at him like, mm-hmm.
Tony Stank. Genius.
No, that was very well done.
Super cool. Yeah. I'll go ahead and offer a prediction. And it's based on two things that have managed to happen with this film. There may be five people prior to the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie for whom any of those characters were their all-time favorites, and they liked them better than Iron Man and better than Spider-Man and Batman and Superman and Captain America and Wonder Woman. But I doubt it. There was not a lot of these characters were firmly D-list characters.
Oh, absolutely.
If you liked them, it was because you liked something about them, but not them. And so he had a lot of agency to change these guys up to make them fit this narrative. These characters in the two Guardians movies have more drift than any of the other Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can look at all the other Marvel Cinematic Universe characters and go, okay, I know who that is. That's at least, you know, that's the core of this character here. They've really rewritten a bunch of stuff for this. And no one's complaining. Because I think in retooling these characters, they've done them all a service, and it fits better into this Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Absolutely.
I'm happy with that. And Joseph said it best, you know, with Yondu, he's unrecognizable as the character from Guardians of the Galaxy comics, but you know, when you hire Michael Rooker, you get a Michael Rooker character, you know, knowing that they hired Michael Rooker, which means this was on purpose. Okay.
Right. Especially since
they're good friends. I mean, Gunn and Rooker are really good friends.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the point.
I mean, to even feed that point, Mark, I mean, I look forward more to another Guardians of the Galaxy movie than I do another Iron Man movie, than I do another Avengers movie, than I do another Ant-Man movie. Those movies are fun and I'll watch them, but I look forward to what they're going to do in Guardians of the Galaxy next. As a kid, I didn't read Guardians of the Galaxy. I was aware of them, but I didn't read that comic. They were very much D-list characters to me.
Yeah. Let me do a quick plug for you. Then the Guardians of the Galaxy comics that have been produced recently since the two movies, they have adapted. They've just went ahead and said, you know what, we're going to run with these guys, and the Bendis run in particular is straight out of the movie and does a great job of scratching that itch. If you want some more,
I'm a fan of Bendis, so that sounds great. That sounds great.
Now we're going to see the Guardians of the Galaxy again in the Infinity War.
Yes,
there's already been photos of them on set. Star-Lord and Tony Stark standing there together, along with Spider-Man, all standing there together. My mind is leaking out of my ears now. It's amazing.
I know, right?
To think about it, right? To imagine. There's also been some unsubstantiated rumors that a certain red mohawked blue alien has been seen on set. Now you go, what? How could that be? And my brother and I were talking about it last night because he was like, well, you know, he's pretty dead. I mean, they incinerated his body, his ashes. Well, yeah, but the Infinity Stones, as you know, can do things like bring people back to life, can reconstitute people, can do all kinds of things.
That's true. They can.
So it's a possibility. And again, that's just rumor, folks, that we haven't seen of that guy.
Huh.
And I wouldn't necessarily mind it. I wouldn't mind it.
Right,
and even if it's something that Thanos uses as a weakness to do with Star-Lord, you know, I've got every reason to think that the same kind of mind game trick will be played with Captain America, which is why we're going to see the Red Skull again. Red Skull lives. That's all.
But no, you're right. Actually, as a tool for Thanos to manipulate Star-Lord, that is very much something that Thanos can promise. Like, I know where Yondu is. I can bring Yondu back.
Well, I would love to see, since the original band is getting back together, I'd love to see Yondu in that group with Charlie 27 and Martin X.
Yeah,
and,
where he belongs.
Yeah, and Starhawk, you know.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh.
I know, nice. Right? Even if Starhawk is of the "let's go steal some shit" category, I'm all right with that. You know, but that's fine.
They come together, right? The two characters to form Starhawk, isn't that right? Yeah, he's almost like what's his name in the DC universe who has to join together
Firestorm.
Yeah. So there's two of them, and they come together. Sylvester Stallone and Michelle Yeoh come together and make Starhawk, whatever the heck that's going to be.
I would be okay with that.
Some deep cuts. I had to research because I had no idea who any of those original Guardians were. Charlie 27. I didn't know.
When I saw the diamond faced guy on the pleasure planet, my first thought was, is that Martin X?
Yeah, that's the only character I recognize.
Real specific.
Yeah, Martin X is the only one I recognize from the Guardian characters.
At the end, when they had Ving Rhames as Charlie 27, I instantly knew who he was, man. I was like, oh, brother, that's cool, man.
For those of you at home that aren't catching what's going on, these are the original Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics.
1968.
Yeah. Not in the film universe. Just in the comics.
Right.
Here's my prediction. I think they've already said we're going to get Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Right.
I would not be surprised if we also get, as part of that package, a Howard the Duck movie from James Gunn.
Oh, my God.
He has campaigned for it. He has put him in two movies. Those two movies were two of the highest grossing movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
They'll let him do Howard the Duck if only to make him happy. Now, we won't get this before 2020, mm-hmm. but I predict that he's going to give us a Howard the Duck movie or a Howard the Duck Netflix series or something. That's going to include all of the stuff that you want to see in a Howard the Duck film. Rewritten and writ large for the modern world. It will be trapped in a world he never made. It will be the Howard the Duck movie that we always wanted but never felt that we really deserved. That's my prediction.
That's all very true.
Okay.
That is Seth Green's voice as Howard the Duck.
Yes, yeah, which I'm okay with. And if Molly Quinn wants to become Bethany for the purposes of this film, I am okay with that. she is delightful, and she would be welcome as Bethany if they're gonna run that way. Who knows? We'll see.
From your lips to Gunn's ears.
Yes.
I don't think anybody's telling any. I don't think anybody's saying anything that Gunn hasn't already said to everybody that will listen.
I love the latitude they're giving him. Marvel's very smart. They know a good creator when they see one. They tend to stick with that person, and that's great. I think Gunn has done such a great job with Guardians. I really want him to continue. I don't really care to see anybody else in the director's seat.
I think he's got it down tonally. There's no reason to change horses in midstream.
Yep.
And he'll have a lot to process after the events of 2018. And so I think that while all that's going on, he needs to work on Howard the Duck. So there you go.
I may be one of the few people. I'm probably one of the few people that just could give a shit about Howard the Duck.
I'm with you.
I do not care if that guy never existed. Yeah. I would be none the either happier or sadder. I just don't care.
I smirked. I smiled. I went, "Oh, look, it's Howard the Duck." That's all I did. I was
exactly.
Like,
but at that point, that could have been anybody. That could have been Mickey. It could have been Pluto. Yeah. I don't care. I just don't care about the character.
Trust Gunn to make you two care.
Okay, well then that is a good challenge. I'll see if even somebody as talented as Gunn can make me like Howard the Duck.
There you go.
I'm with Mark on that. Kind of in your camp, but with Mark on that, because all I know about Howard the Duck is the original movie, ain't it?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right.
Speaking of spoilers at the end there, that said, I'm very much looking forward to Adam Warlock. God, let's see what Gunn does with Adam freaking Warlock.
And with some of Alicia's lines, it almost sounds like they somehow got samples of Star-Lord's DNA.
I don't know.
That'd be cool. That'd be cool. I missed that. What led you to believe that?
I don't remember. It's been a couple weeks. I don't remember the exact line, but she's talking about something about changing and adding some unusual DNA or something into the mix.
Right.
Which suggested celestial DNA.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's unfortunately a whole cosmic realm of possibilities.
Yeah,
yeah.
That it just wouldn't have been possible for them to do that unless we get a secret scene where Peter Quill snuck back and
but just actual a genetic sample like skin or whatever from.
Oh, maybe I don't know.
Because Gunn is so big on family connections.
Yeah,
all of the Guardians movies are supposed to have a family theme to them somehow.
Well, there's other Celestials and other Titans out there this could all be part and parcel of. So,
I'm really sad to see or to know that the rights to Galactus and the are not in Marvel's camp now. Still, they're still tied with the Fantastic Four in the Nebula limbo that's in, which is sad. I love to see, like, when I saw the Watchers, I just squealed. I got so excited because I was like, oh my God, the Watchers. Oh my God. And look at them. They're beautiful. They're perfect. They're big and the capes and the white, big, giant, bald, white eyes. And
it's
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm so excited. And then I got instantly sad because I thought I'll never see the Watcher holding up the nullifier to Galactus. I'll never see that in a Marvel movie because Galactus isn't, you know.
The only thing I know.
He was a cloud.
Yeah.
The only thing
plus
I know
Galactus, I think, is one of those. Galactus is part of the Fantastic Four, so Fox owns that right now.
Exactly.
And the only
it's
thing
not
I
gonna,
that's what I'm saying.
I'll tell you, I don't at this point I don't miss the Fantastic Four in the same way that I don't miss the mutants. As it stands, we're gonna find out on 2018 what the breaking point is. This will be I think 2018's Infinity War double feature is going to be a real test of the system. We've done big movies. We've put characters in these big movies. People are invested. This is something we've been building towards. Let's put them all together and see if we can make it work. If they can pull it off, if it's more successful than a failure, then there really won't be an upper limit. Yeah. I suspect that it'll work, but they won't want to try it again. And I think that with the Guardians basically covering the emotional territory that the Fantastic Four covers, not the space pirates angle, all the rest of you out there, talk about Farscape on your own time. But with the Guardians covering the emotional territory and with the Inhumans covering the emotional territory of the mutants, I think those things can be over there, not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I don't think we lose anything.
I disagree. Right. I just want to see a giant purple bucket-headed monster who wants to eat the planet. That's what I want. I want to see Galactus.
I would love to see a Fantastic Four movie.
But it's terrifying. When Alex Ross paints Galactus, it's terrifying.
If only that could happen. I don't necessarily miss. I mean, you're right. The kind of stories that we usually see or have seen in Fantastic Four are being covered by Guardians, but still, in my mind, the Guardians are not the Fantastic Four, not even close. They have family issues, but so do the X-Men. For me, the Fantastic Four stand on their own as their own. I mean, come on, the Negative Zone, Annihilus, Galactus. They dealt
Blastar,
with
Blastar, the Living Bomb Burst.
Yes,
oh, I know. I'm a Fantastic Four fan.
They dealt with such wonderfully fun. And that's the problem with, I think, the Fantastic Four, certainly the last one they did. Where was the fun? Where was the fun in that last Fantastic Four movie? Oh my God!
It's gonna take a lot more money being lost before they get them back. And I, you know, maybe it's a way to restart. I don't know. We'll see. at this point, Fox is putting all of their X-Men eggs into one basket. They're putting three movies out next year, which should be the end of their contract. But they're also doubling down with this Legion series,
which is fantastic.
Which was amazing. So who knows?
Has done really well. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So I would be okay with Fox keeping the mutants if Legion is going to be the new direction. I agree. The Fantastic Four is getting the short shift. It really is. And we still haven't seen the Thing the way we all know it could be.
Yeah.
It could be shown, you know, like we're not there yet. Yeah. I'm sympathetic to you, but, I'm really at this point, I'm not wanting them to throw anything onto the tracks that could derail what they've done.
Right.
They're 15 and 0 right now.
Well, they've had a couple of slips, but you know, let's be frank. Ant-Man wasn't huge, but see what I did there?
That's good. That is clever.
And by the way, speaking of Galactus and the Heralds and Blastar the Living Bomb Burst and these types of outrageous characters, when they were doing the multiple jumps to get to Ego, did anyone think they saw Terax the Tamer on that planet with a giant axe?
Yep, I thought that was Terax.
You know, funny. And I was like, I liked that. It was just like, hey, what is that? Oh, and we're off, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, guys, Maximilian's giving us the red eye. I'm afraid we've once again talked our way into closing down the Lobot Lounge. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this podcast of the Gentlemen Nerds. Final thoughts and the Guardians of the Galaxy and the great universe that James Gunn has brought us yet again.
I wanted to do a sneak preview. I wanted to talk about, very briefly, Wonder Woman. The early reviews are in, and they're stellar. So I cannot wait. I cannot wait for me and my fellow nerds to dive into the Wonder Woman movie. Certainly we will try to do a podcast very soon around the opening or just after the opening. So I'm very excited about that. But as far as Guardians, keep it coming. Keep it coming.
Keep it coming, folks. Mickey?
We need the Hulk on the ship. Dead silence.
I agree.
Crickets.
I agree. No, we need need anyone. Everyone needs a Hulk.
No one heard those rumors from previous?
No.
Oh, okay. No. From the way that James Gunn was talking about things, people thought the Hulk might show up in Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm like, just the mental image of Ruffalo playing off Rocket and then the Hulk playing off Drax is just awesome.
All right. Well, he needs to, maybe he'll hitch a ride back to Earth with them. I mean, he needs a way to get back. So,
And we don't even know how he gets to where he is in Ragnarok.
That's true. That's true. We'll
cover that. Mark?
I only have three quick things in closing. I am Groot.
Nice.
Yo, that's the button that'll kill everyone.
Does anyone have any tape? ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for joining us. I'm Joseph Fatinos, once again telling you all that the Red Skull lives. Good night, folks.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive.
Promotional consideration by Zoom, the Walkman of the future.
Yeah. You may well be onto something at this point. Who knows?
Yeah,
I'm grasping at desperate straws there. But
if he's going to come back in anything, he's going to come back in Infinity Wars.
It'll be at the end of part one, is what it'll be.
And by the way, who said? Was it you, Joseph, or was it Mark that said? Which is brilliant, and I think that's why they're introducing her in the next Thor movie. But that in Infinity War, Thanos is actually going to be in love with Hela, not Death. They're not going to bring Death as a separate incarnation. They're going to bring Kate Blanchett in as Hela, as Death. That is who he is in love with.
That's the connection. Okay. Yeah. Well, see, I thought I saw Death on the rock of at the beginning of the Infinity or the first Avengers movie, where they show Thanos out in space and Loki making the deal.
Someone's standing there next to him.
Isn't there a purple cloaked figure there?
There are a lot of purple cloaked figures.
I think, and again, I may be totally wrong. I think the connection is that that's just an avatar of Hela, or Hela is an avatar of Death. It's the same. It's essentially the same character.
But you know, remember at the end of the first Avengers, when his whatever assistant or whatever tells him, to face them is to court Death, and he turns and he smiles. Uh-huh. I always thought that was a nice little nod to the fact that he was in love with Death.
Yeah.
You know,
We'll see. I may be wrong, and then bring in somebody.
It would make a terrific. It would really connect everything if they did
it
that. Would. That's smart.
Yeah. Yeah,
would. And just explain it as Hela is just an incarnation. That is no more Death than another Death goddess somewhere else. They're all the same character. But anyway, it would be interesting.